Hey guys, just a quick hello from me, Barry here, before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with Seb Falk, all about the world's worst map. First thing to say is this was such a fun episode to do. We recorded about an hour and 45 minutes, which as you can see has been edited down, so there's going to be lots of tasty little offcuts for our donors on Patreon. And speaking of people donating on Patreon, we've got to give a welcome to our two latest donors. Welcome Keith Gilmore, who's donating $3 a month. You will be entitled to receive some of that bonus extra content that we put out on patreon.com. And thank you Catherine Adams for donating on behalf of Hannah Wallace. We got a lovely message from Catherine after she set up her donation of $5 a month saying this is a birthday present to Hannah Wallace, who directed Catherine to our podcast. And what a lovely idea, what a nice thing to do. So thank you to both of you, I guess. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Hannah, for sending her our way. And at $5 a month, you'll also be getting our bonus Patreon content, as well as Hannah being able to put forward a topic for an episode for us. So we look forward to sorting that out in the very near future. Other than that, just the usual stuff. If you want to get involved on Patreon, visit patreon.com/worstfootforward, and you can find out ways of donating and helping us continue to make the podcast. Ben and I had our first brainstorm last week, first serious sit-down brainstorm last week about what format a Worst Foot Forward book would take and what stuff we'll start putting in. We've started a spreadsheet with topics and chapter headings and stories we definitely want in and all sorts of things. It's tremendously exciting. So yes, anyone who donates on Patreon will be helping us to achieve that goal of getting a Worst Foot Forward book out in the not too near future, but in the midterm near future. If you want to support us in other ways, of course, you can give us a shout out on Twitter. We're on @WorstFoot. I'm on @BasMaxDay. Ben's on @BenVandeveld. You can also find us on Facebook, we're on Worst Foot Forward, and our website is worstfootforwardpodcast.com. Also, if you just want to get in touch and say hi, as a few people have done recently, just, you know, tell us what you're liking about the podcast, tell us how you're doing, then you can get in touch on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. And at the very least, if you're enjoying the show, like Hannah did for Catherine, just recommend us to a friend. That's a really nice way of helping us grow and continue. That's it for now. I'm sitting recording this in the smallest room in my flat, and it is so hot. For listeners who aren't in the UK, we're experiencing a heat wave at the moment. So if I spend any longer recording, I may just melt. You might be able to hear me dripping into the microphone. So I'm going to let you get on with enjoying the podcast. Enjoy the rest of your day. And as ever, thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Now sit back, relax, and let us take you on a trip around the world to places that exist and some that don't, in our episode about the world's worst map.
Hello, mighty listeners, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week uncovers the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vandeveld, and today you find me stuck in the middle of a field repeating the mantra, "It's definitely around here somewhere," over and over as a plea to the cartographical gods. We've been on the hunt for buried treasure, and it appears that either X doesn't mark the spot, or there are so many natural features that look like the letter X. It turns out that from above, the UK looks like an enormous insoluble quadratic equation, which, incidentally, is also how it has been described by the EU's chief mathematician and several historians from the 23rd century. Aren't the end times fun? Still, once we find the buried treasure, I'm sure we'll feel perfectly moral about keeping it over here, even if it does have something like "Property of Georgios Christopoulou, Retsina Street, Athens," written on its bottom. Finders, keepers, and all that. And with me is the wiggly river to my pointy mountains, the terra incognita to my terrier incognito, and the fluctuating magnetic field to my wayward compass. It's Barry McStay.
If Britain from overhead looks like a quadratic equation, surely it's not all X's. Because that's quite an easy quadratic equation if it's all X's. There need to be some Y's.
That is a good point.
That must be why there's a river Y.
Ah, of course.
Isn't there's river X's as well, isn't there?
Yeah, Exmouth and Exeter.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, fine.
Is there an equal sign?
Yeah. the market town of equal sign. I think it's in Bedfordshire, right?
Oh, at last, we've solved the United Kingdom.
Oh, no, that's a long way from being solved, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem with the equation of the United Kingdom is that it's mostly all about division rather than multiplication at the moment.
Very good.
There we go. That's the intro sorted. Let's introduce our guest. Our guest this week studied history and Spanish at Oxford and worked first in the Home Office before becoming a school teacher, while nowadays parents are working in the home and being school teachers. He worked in schools both in the UK and Canada, teaching history, sailing and singing, essentially the Gilbert and Sullivan hat trick. Then he crossed the Oxbridge Divide to Cambridge, gaining an MPhil in History and Philosophy of Science, followed by a PhD. He's been a research fellow at Girton College and has also been a research fellow at the Bavarian Academy of Sciences and Humanities, which is my favourite academic institution I've ever heard of. He's also a BBC New Generation thinker, making radio and short films for the BBC, including John Gower, the Forgotten Medieval Poet. Nope, me neither. Monks, Models and Medieval Time, sounds like a Lost Carry On movie, and Exploring the Mariner's Astrolabe. Yep. I mean, do your own jokes, guys. I went for it. Reminds me of that time I went on a Mediterranean cruise. His book, The Light Ages, is to be published in September this year, and he also has a particular interest in how mathematical sciences, especially astronomy, were studied and practiced outside of universities by non-experts. Even the experts like him are tired of experts, but given how an expert we are on this show, he'll fit in perfectly. It's Dr. Seb Falk.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. You've got a very impressive CV. Oxford and Cambridge, if you don't mind.
They balance each other out nicely.
Is it like defecting during the Cold War?
Yeah, a little bit like that. I had a problem because I ran cross-country races in Oxford, and well, I mean, in Cambridge we don't have any hills, so it's best if you go to Oxford to do it. But the first time I did it, there were a few very brave spectators in the rain, and they were all cheering, "Come on, Oxford! Come on, Oxford!" And that was a real lift to me, because I still thought of myself as being at Oxford, so I was kind of being cheered by the wrong side and getting something out of it. So I've never quite come to terms with my defection, I'm afraid.
I thought that when you were running that race, surely now when you run it, you just have a light blue and a dark blue top on, and then when you get closer to the line, you decide who you'd like to win for, and if you're like, "Do you know what? We'll give this one to Cambridge," and you pull a top off and reveal an Oxford one underneath.
I think the light blue and the dark blue just sums up how basically similar they are. Like, yeah. Everybody in Cambridge is like, "Boo, Oxford," and everyone in Oxford is like, "Oh, Cambridge." You know that Cambridge was founded by students who were kicked out of Oxford for getting drunk and beating up local townspeople.
Really?
Yeah, very soon after Oxford was founded, the student, like, the whole town v gown thing has a really long history, and the students weren't subject to local law because they were basically ruled over by the church. So the church could set the rules and the students would be judged by the church if they did anything naughty. So on one occasion, I think what happened was some student got himself into trouble, murdered a local townsperson. The townspeople lynched the student's housemates because they couldn't find the guy who'd actually done it. So they lynched his housemates. This started a riot. The students and the teachers all walked out for like 4 years. They went on strike. And some of them were like, "Oh, I'm bored of this now." And they went over to Cambridge and set up a new university there.
Wow. So Cambridge is essentially Animal House.
Yeah. Cambridge is, yeah, where all the like rebels and reprobates from Oxford went.
Now, we have discovered, thanks to Barry's reeling off of your enormous CV, which he read from a vellum scroll, that you are incredibly qualified human. But what is it that you are worst at in the world?
I've struggled so much with this question because I couldn't make up my mind, because probably the thing that I'm worst at in the whole world is making decisions. Mm. I just can't decide. Can't decide what I'm worst at. Can't decide anything at all.
I love it. We've invited a professional academic on the show, and true to form, you are being cheedy from The Good Place.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I wanted to happen.
But did that happen? You went to Oxford and you thought, "Oh, I'm better go to Cambridge as well." If you ever go to Harvard, does that mean you have to do all these seven others in the Ivy League as well?
I mean, I guess so.
Yeah. Just complete the full set.
I think it comes from being like a youngest child. I had two older sisters who always told me what to do. And so I grew up basically doing exactly what I was told. And then when I became an adult and someone said to me, actually, you've got to make some decisions for yourself, I'm like, I've got no training for this. I have no idea what to do. So I just hope that somebody will come along and tell me what to do. And then I do it. And then I move on to the next thing. I should have been in the army, really.
Wear a mask, vote Labour. There you go. Sorted.
Yeah. But Labour is exactly right, because, you know, of course, the whole thing about socialism is somebody else is making the decisions. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, the Tories come along and say, you know, we're going to give you more choice. But why would I want more choice? just make all of the schools okay and all of the hospitals okay and take away our choice and I'll be fine with that.
That is the most convincing party political broadcast I think I've ever heard.
Hello, Worst Foot Forward listeners. This is Anna Pajaiski here, just popping in to say that if you're loving the Worst Foot Forward podcast feed, then you might also enjoy my podcast about materials and making called Handmade. The purpose of the podcast is to bring science and art into conversation and to show that sometimes they're not as separate as you might think.
So I'm very interested in using embroidery to explore what's going down at this sort of quantum level, like entropy and things, and how about the random nature of like atoms and particles.
The conversations range from the sublime.
We live in a world bristling and brimming with extraordinary illusions. You put a straw in a glass of water and it bends and you don't think about it anymore, but it really is a remarkable phenomenon. And so for me, glass is kind of everyday magic.
To the ridiculous.
Full penetration butt world. It's a serious thing.
But always with the aim to inspire, inform and intrigue listeners about the wonderful world of materials. You can find us by searching for Handmade wherever you find your podcasts.
It is time to open our ordnance survey and find our way, because this week we're going to be talking about the world's worst maps. And we invited Seb on the show because we, like him, are fascinated by the world of medieval marginalia, and maps are one of the places where that occurs most often. But before he opens out his 17 ply A to Z of Byzantium, Barry is going to kick us off. What did you find, Barry?
Funny you should mention the A to Z. I was reading about Phyllis Pearsall yesterday, who is the woman credited with, if you like, assembling the A to Z of London, the definitive roadmap of the greater London area. And you can sort of look up all the street names alphabetized at the back, and people wandering around Trafalgar Square turning them side to side before, you know, Google Maps were invented. But Phyllis Pearsall, she's said to have walked 23,000 streets of London over the course of 18-hour days. Not true. She said herself, not true. She would have to go and, you know, do, as she said, the footwork herself if she wasn't sure about the layout of some areas. When the first edition of the A to Z was published, her father asked her, he'd been a map maker as well, her father asked her why it didn't have Trafalgar Square in the index. He said, imagine leaving Trafalgar Square out of the A to Z. She explained that the reason she'd done that, she knocked a box of index cards with the T's out of her window in High Holborn one day and hadn't retrieved all of them.
That's like the dictionary episode of Blackadder the Third has come to life.
Yeah. I have to say, I got the story from Simon Garfield's excellent book On the Map. If anyone hasn't read that, I highly recommend it. I read about sex maps or shag maps. Essentially, this is, you know, you get a map of the country you live in or the city you live in or the world, and you put pins in the areas where the places where you've had sex. And you can go to the shagmap.com from Jason Headley, who's a co-writer of Pixar's recent movie Onward, and it has a map of the US states and their electoral college votes, and you click on the ones where you've had sex, and if you get 270 votes, you're a presidential shagger. Have you heard of the Mullough-Kintyre test?
Oh, we've talked about that on the show before, yeah. Which is about, obviously, you're not allowed to show an erect penis on British television unless they're standing at a plinth during a Number 10 briefing. And so it's if the gentleman's member is any further, I was about to say aloof, I meant aloft, any further aloft than the Mullough-Kintyre.
Yes, the Mullough-Kintyre is a peninsula, or the Kintyre Peninsula is a peninsula in Scotland. The Mull is the tip of it. But it does look slightly like a dangling genital if you look at the way it hangs off the edge of Scotland. It's probably not true, but there is a story that the British Board of Film Classification ruled that penises are not to be shown on British TV or film if they're more erect than the Mull of Kintyre. It's also not true that you can't show an erect penis on British television. It just has to be within context, apparently. There's not going to be someone there with, like, a protractor with an atlas in the other hand who's checking.
Well, I sort of imagine that just Graham Chapman in full military regalia comes on and measures the angle. It's like, okay, that's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah. I did look a bit at Tube maps, the Tube being the London Underground system. Do you know the name of the guy who designed the first diagrammatic Tube map?
Considering how many pub quizzes I've hosted, I should, but I cannot remember it.
Shameful. A guy called Harry Beck in 1931.
Ah, yes.
He was a London Underground employee. And he realised that because the railway's underground, the physical locations of the stations are basically irrelevant. You just need to know how to get from one station to another station, so it's only the topology of the route. But he did this, it wasn't a commission. They were sort of sceptical, London Underground were sceptical of his proposal. And so they just introduced it to the public in a small pamphlet in 1933, but it became really popular. And so they've used topological maps to illustrate the network ever since. Earlier Tube maps overlaid, you know, the city with just the railway lines. There was a map called the Tube Map in 1907 that the Evening News, a newspaper, commissioned. It was the first one to show all the lines with equal weight given to each line and used different colours as well. But Beck's map definitely was the one that suddenly sprung into popular imagination. And he continued to design the Tube Map until 1960, except for 1939, an addition by a guy called Hans Schager. He did work under the pseudonym of Zero. It has to be said. Yeah. In 1960, Beck did his last design, which was very similar to the modern design. And then he was replaced by a guy called Harold Hutchison, who was the publicity officer for London Transport and not really known as a designer. So he had a bash at doing a map. And I read a review of it by some people. It was the first Tube map to use lower cases in some station names, so it made it easier to read. It wasn't all capital letters, but it made the interchange stations more capitalized, so you could sort of pick out the more important stations if you like. But it hasn't any curves. It's all very sharp diagonals. So Beck's map uses straight lines, horizontal, vertical, and 45 degree lines only. Hutchison's horizontal lines, rather than sort of sloping into a curve or sharp angles, which looks a bit stilted, and it's very cramped around Bank and Monument and Liverpool Street, so much so that the word Aldgate has to be broken up either side of a line to fit into a tiny little diamond space. And so yeah, it's not as effective nowadays. On the back of the Tube maps, when you see them, there is a little notice saying that this diagram is an evolution of the original design conceived in 1931 by Harry Beck. I did look at other tube and subway maps from around the world, and there are some really good ones. The Washington DC's one is quite good. If anyone's ever seen that, there's only about 5 lines, and they're all called the Green Line, which is green, and the red line, which is red. If you look at Stuttgart's underground, I didn't realize Stuttgart had a subway, nay, as many stations as apparently it does when you look at its map, but it's on a tilt, like you're looking at it from above, but at an angle, which is really disconcerting somehow when you're used to looking at a tube map directly, like top down. Melbourne has recently changed their map, but the old map was just in blue and yellow, despite the fact it had loads of different lines. Now they've gone to colour coding, but previously just had a blue line and yellow lines. Lisbon's is a geographical map, so it isn't diagrammatic. It is geographical, but Lisbon's stations are all quite spread out and it doesn't have that many of them. Whereas Mexico City's one of its official maps, is geographical and includes the streets above as well. So it's a nightmare.
Wow. The one that always scares me is Tokyo's, because that looks like Jackson Pollock trying to do cubism.
There's so many stations on the Tokyo map. Obviously, it's written in, is it kanji characters? And it's very condensed.
Mexico City's one, what impressed me when I went there was all of the stations have a little symbol, like a little pictographic symbol, which someone told me, I don't know if this is true, was because the literacy levels in the city weren't like super high. And so if people couldn't read the name of the station, that would help. I don't know if that's true, but if you go around, all of the little stations have a little picture.
That's great. I sort of hope that, archaeologists of the very distant future will uncover a Mexico City underground map and be like, good lord, they've got hieroglyphics on here as well.
I read a little bit about some of the early mapping efforts in Antarctica. I read about the British Association for the Advancement of Science, who sponsored the journey of Sir James Clark Ross, an English naval officer. He journeyed to Antarctica on board the Erebus and the Terror. Interesting name for a ship, I've always thought that. And basically, he and his crew named everything they could see. Just, you know, family, friends, heroes, benefactors. If there's a mountain, if there's a cape, if there's a little cove, a tiny cave, they would name literally everything they saw.
Well, I guess the thing is, if you're a cartographer rather than an author, you don't get to have an acknowledgement section of your book. So yes. You just put it on the map.
Yeah, it's very true. Simon Garfield comments, it is rare to find an area of new geography so full of civil servants.
We named a bit of Antarctica after him because we wished he was there.
Yeah, well, you go from Cape North and you go vertically through Cape Hooker. These are all surnames: Cape Hooker, Moore, Wood, Adair, Downshire, McCormick, Christie, Hallett, and Cotter. And Ross even named one cape Cape Anne because it was discovered on the birthday of a lady to whom I was then attached. That's a risk, isn't it?
Better than a tattoo.
He did then later marry her, which is good, but. Do you know about projections, Ben?
Broadly speaking, yes. There's Mr. Mercator, who is the chap who tried to solve the problem of mapping a... Now, the globe's not a sphere, is it? It's an ovoid? Is that what we are?
Oblate spheroid.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And trying to pop that onto a flat rectangular plane is tricky. But that's what projection is. But aren't there also colonial overtones where they went, can we just make Africa look a little bit smaller and Britain a little bit bigger, please?
Yeah, the world map most of us are at least grew up with. There are a few more variations now, but the one a lot of us will know is the Mercator projection, where basically it's quite good for navigation, which is one of the benefits of it. It inflates landmass as you move away from the equator. So as you go north and south, it makes those landmasses get bigger. To try and flatten, as you say, the sphere. However, if you look at a Mercator projection, Greenland is larger than Africa. Do you want to guess the ratio of size between Greenland and Africa in reality?
I mean, in reality, I would say that Africa is probably 1,000 times bigger than Greenland.
Not 1,000, but it is 14 times bigger.
Okay.
And in fact, this is a plot point in the West Wing, season 2, episode 16. Somebody's going to emergency, somebody's going to jail. CJ Craig, played by Alison Janney, is made to sit down and listen to a cartographer's association where they encourage America and schools to adopt the Peters projection, or the Gall-Peters projection, to give it the more widespread used name. It focuses on size. Areas of equal size on the globe are equally sized on the map, which sacrifices accuracy in other areas. But by doing this, Peters argues that poorer, less powerful nations are restored to their rightful proportions. Because as you say, on the Mercator projection, Africa is made to look smaller. Britain is, you know, Europe is in the middle and looks bigger than it actually is. So the Gall-Peters projection has been adopted by groups like Oxfam, the National Council of Churches, the New Internationalist Magazine, and the Mennonite Central Committee, among others. But there was a lot of pushback in the cartographical circles. And Peters wrote in 1983, philosophers, astronomers, historians, popes, and mathematicians have all drawn global maps long before cartographers as such existed. Cartographers appeared in the Age of Discovery, which developed into the Age of European Conquest and Exploitation and took over the task of making maps. By the authority of their profession, they have hindered its development. Since Mercator produced his global map over 400 years ago for the Age of Europeans' world domination, cartographers have clung to it, despite its having long been outdated by events. They have sought to render it topical by cosmetic corrections.
But I mean, every kind of map is a compromise, right? There's always going to be a problem. Peters is massive, like it's got the right sizes, but it massively distorts the shape.
Yes.
So if you're looking at like the Arctic, everything's really squashed top to bottom.
Yes.
And in like around the equator, everything's really squeezed from side to side. So the only things that are the right shape are around 45 degrees. Like France and Spain look okay,
yeah,
but like Britain already is quite squashed. So it looks a bit kind of chubby.
And actually what that has done is made Europe and America still the most geographically accurate in terms of their shaping. So it still, in a way, weights towards them. Then I started looking at older, more interesting, less accurate maps. I read about a guy called Heinrich Bunting, a Protestant pastor and theologian, who created a book of woodcut maps titled Itinerarium Sacrae Scripturae, which is a travel book through Holy Scripture produced in 1581, which includes several decent, for the time, maps, but also includes three figurative maps, the world depicted using a clover leaf, with Jerusalem at the centre, and nice. Europe, Asia and Africa as the three leaves, which hilariously, there are two islands to the north, England and Denmark. And and then in the bottom corner, bottom left-hand corner, is America. He also did a brilliant map of Europe in the form of a crowned and robed woman, which I really like, on its side. So Spain and Lusitania are the crown. Italy is her right arm holding an orb, Sicily. Bohemia is her navel, and Hungary is in her lady parts, if you're interested. Uh-huh. And in 1599, a few years after that, a guy called Battista Boasio produced a map of Ireland, which was because there was a lot of public interest during the Tudor conquest of Ireland at the time. But it was so big, there weren't enough known place names to fill it in. So he just made some up, including Elstrack's Isle, after the engraver Reynold Elstrack, and Baptiste's Rock, after himself. And I really like this story. A guy called Moses Pitt in the 1600s, he was a bookseller and printer who tried to produce an atlas. So the early atlases around this time were magnificent works of art from the Netherlands and the great Flemish printers. And basically he went, we haven't got one of these in Britain, I'm going to do this. And so he proposed the English Atlas, a title a guy called John Ogilby had been using for his own geographies, so Pitt waited until Ogilby died to announce it as the title of his project. It was going to have 12 volumes with 600 maps spread out over 900 sheets, apparently. He continued to undertake lots of other work at the same time, but with rising costs estimated by Pitt at £1,000 per volume, or £100,000 today.
Wow.
Drove him to bankruptcy, and only four volumes of it were ever produced. And he was taken to the Fleet Debtor's Prison for 7 years, where he published, shortly after being there, he published The Cry of the Oppressed, being a true and tragical account of the unparalleled sufferings of multitudes of poor imprisoned debtors in most of the jails in England, an appeal on behalf of prisoners for debt across the country. So not only did we get, well, not a complete atlas, but a third of an atlas from him, but we also got a really interesting account of what it was like in debtor's prison in the 17th century from him as well. But then I discovered Professor, in inverted commas, Orlando Ferguson, who produced a map of the square and stationary earth.
Wow.
So Ferguson was born in Duquoine in Illinois in 1846 and moved to Dakota in the 1880s, settling in Hot Springs, Dakota. And he ran a grocery store and later built a hotel. And when that was burnt down, he then built a bathhouse. And a lot of the sick people there referred to him as Dr. Ferguson, because he was, you know, the guy who built it, even though he wasn't a doctor. So, and then he called himself Professor in his publishings. He was neither a doctor nor a professor, so already we're off to a fine worst foot forward start. And in 2011, he came to press attention in America because a copy of his 1893 Flat Earth map was donated to and accepted by the Library of Congress, a square and stationary earth based on his literal interpretation of the Bible, which references angels visiting the four corners of the world.
And it's his literal interpretation of the book of Revelations,
yes,
as well, which I feel like is not the best book of the Bible on which to base a projection of the world.
Yeah, in fact, yeah. He lectured on the idea in 1891 before publishing it. He followed up with a 60-page pamphlet full of hypotheses based on 400 different Bible passages backing up his theory that the world was both flat and square.
I have, when he first said it, I was thinking a cube. Yeah. And I was like, oh, but then you need eight corners, but no.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was going to ask Seb. So there's, from my layman's approach, is that there's always a tension between what is found by mathematicians and scientists and what there is in the Bible. So we're map makers in medieval times, people who used the Bible to inform their art.
This is what my map is going to show very much. In great detail, but I think it's really important to say that this idea of reading the Bible literally, trying to get information out of it, scrape it for cartographic information, like your chap Ferguson did, is actually quite a modern idea. Like, medieval people were totally comfortable with the idea of reading the Bible as being allegorical. Yeah. And the maps often show that, so which is why you have to be really careful reading maps, because actually the maps have the same allegories in them as the biblical text, and they're still allegories. Mm. So we look at maps and we think this is supposed to be a literal description of the world, but it's not. It's just like any other kind of text.
Yeah, a lot of it grew out of the pushback against Darwin, I think, this idea of reading the Bible. It's trying to refute science with, if you like, this is taking the Bible as a scientific textbook itself. Ferguson was not the only person talking about the Earth not being a globe at the time. In 1885, a guy called William Carpenter published 100 Proofs That the Earth Is Not a Globe. And even earlier than that, an English guy called Samuel Rowbotham had published a book called Zetetic Astronomy, Earth Not a Globe! Exclamation mark. Ferguson's map, and I encourage people to look at it, shows the, if you imagine like a flat square tile of like a soft material, and you were to squish a donut down into it and then lift the donut back up again, that's basically what his Earth looks like, which is how he explains the whole idea that of horizons. The reason that a ship's hull disappears is that it's actually sort of, if you like, disappearing down into the dip where the sea is. That's how he gets away with saying, oh, horizons, you see, it's because the sea dips down from the Earth. He has an angel on the four corners of the picture. He also has a little picture of men hanging onto a little globe at the side of it.
Nice.
Which is it's a globe hurtling through space and two guys clinging onto it, and the caption is, these men are flying on the globe at a rate of 65,000 miles per hour around the sun and at 1,042 miles per hour around the center of the Earth. Brackets in their minds, think of that speed.
It's got a real sort of vibe of an Abbott and Costello sketch before its time.
Yeah, it also says, send 25 cents to the author for a book explaining this square and stationary Earth. It knocks the globe theory clean out. It'll teach you how to foretell eclipses. It is worth its weight in gold. The idea of it being stationary as well, you can see in the picture that actually the sun and the moon and the stars are they're hung on like arced arms that in from the center, from the pole, if you like, of the Earth, and so they're moving around the Earth as well. And he says basically the reason men haven't been around the world in the way that you could be on a globe, he says, well, draw a large circle in a room, carry a light around that circle, and the circle is the equator and the lamp is the sun. So you've set out to the west and you're following the sun and you'll end up coming back to where you started, but you've only gone in a circle. That doesn't quite explain why the sun disappears or, you know, doesn't somehow appear over to your right when it was in front of you. But, you know, he's thought about, you know, the potential arguments, and he'll have to, you know, push back against those. My favourite argument he made was, some people will say when the Earth passes between the sun and the moon, its shadow on the moon is circular, so the Earth is a globe. Mm. He says, this does not prove anything except to those who take the shadow for substance. We love a flat earther on this show. You know, pass himself off as a professor. I quite liked Orlando Ferguson. Fairly harmless and largely forgotten until recently.
Harmless, forgotten, flat earther, Midwest American. A lot to tick off the bingo card there.
Yeah.
Well, I brought you a map that is pretty well known, at least in kind of circles of people that are interested in maps. And it's the Hereford Mappa Mundi, which you might have heard of, at Hereford Cathedral, made around 1300, so the later Middle Ages. And it's about the size of a double bedsheet, so it's a pretty big map. It's about 5 feet square, and it is made of an entire calf skin. So they got a cow, they slaughtered it, they cut it down the belly, they opened it out.
And inside was a map of the world.
It's kind of the shape that you would expect. It's a little bit longer than it is wide. It's kind of got a neck to it. And then they sort of chopped off it's got corners more or less where the legs of the cow are. If you imagine getting a calf and kind of opening it out.
Yeah, spatchcocking a calf.
Exactly, exactly. Like I say, it's a square with the triangle on top. And at the very top of the apex of the triangle is Jesus Christ. Not on every map. But certainly on this one, and a few angels.
Here be dragons, here be messiahs.
There are dragons. It doesn't say here be dragons, but there are dragons on this map. They're dragons that are on a little island. Well, actually, they're in a few places, but there's some really cute dragons on a little island in the Red Sea.
Oh, nice.
And then, of course, in the middle, for almost all, taking up almost all of the space of the Karskine, is this big circular map. Not a map of the entire world, it's really important to say, but a map of the inhabited world, a map of the world that was known to humans at that time. It's crap by our standards, because we have certain standards for what should be in a map and what shouldn't be in a map. But it actually does what it sets out to achieve pretty brilliantly, with a few exceptions, which I do have to tell you about, like the fact that they mislabeled Africa and Europe. So Africa is labeled Europe and Europe is labeled Africa.
Isn't that just foreshadowing colonialism by a few centuries?
Nobody has come up with a plausible explanation for how that might conceivably be deliberate. I think that's just a cock-up. But other things that we consider to be a bit silly are actually entirely part of the design of the map. And in a way, I think the best way to think about this map, it's more like one of those picture books that if you've got kids, you've got for your children. I've got one of these here, which is this kind of children's book of maps.
Yeah.
And if I turn to the page for the UK, I find that in the Scottish borders around about Galla Shields, there's a giant hedgehog. And taking up the whole of Devon is a sort of cartoonish lopsided picture of King Arthur. And these maps, but the point of these maps, right, is to kind of evoke a place.
Mm.
The point about the Hereford Mappamundi is that it does a similar job, right? It's not a map of the world in the sense that it's just describing what is in each place. It's telling a story. And that story is the providential story of human history. It's creation. It's the stories from the Bible. And it's not just telling us where we've been, it's also telling us where we're going to go. So it's kind of a pictographic history rather than a description of what's in the world. But of course, that history is full of really awesome, exciting things. So on Crete, you've got the Minotaur. In near the Black Sea, you've got the Golden Fleece of Jason and the Argonauts. You've got all of the really important biblical stories. So right at the middle is Jerusalem. Jerusalem was at the middle of the world. East, by the way, is at the top. Christian maps tended to be east at the top. And the map is based on a really familiar old scheme. It's called the TO map. And the TO map basically is a T inside an O. So you've got a capital T inside a circle. And above the line of the T, which runs across the middle, is Asia. And the bottom left corner that's made by the vertical bit of the T is Europe, if you've labeled it correctly.
It's very hard to tipex a cow, though.
Yeah, you've got to wait for the milk to congeal enough so you can make tipex.
We don't know what draft this is. They might have gone through the entire herd and gone, fuck it. If the only mistake we have on this final draft is that we've mislabeled Africa and Europe, well, it'll have to do.
That's a good idea, actually. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
Because it was probably, nobody quite knows how this map came to be, because it was probably designed at Lincoln. Because the guy who's identified as being the designer of this map, in the bottom left-hand corner, there's a quote from the Bible, which often you might recognize if you go to sort of Christmas services, that, you know, Caesar Augustus sent out a decree that the whole world should be surveyed. And this is clearly a kind of inspiration for the map. And then at the bottom, you've got this guy, Richard of Haldingham, who was a prebend of Lincoln Cathedral. So he's kind of a churchman at Lincoln Cathedral. And Lincoln on the map is quite sort of well detailed, and the area of Lincolnshire has quite a lot in it, but it was clearly made at Hereford. There's stages to this. So yeah, maybe somebody got confused in the middle and you know, they had one job to do, which was to fill in the names of Europe and Africa in gold leaf, and they didn't quite manage it.
I don't fully understand why they've made the world with this T shape, with Asia at the top and Europe down the shaft of the T, rather than the shapes we would come to expect.
Well, I mean, I think it was known that Asia was big. So if you're going to divide the world into three, you've got to give Asia the biggest part. Actually, the shaft and the crossbar are water. So the Mediterranean Sea is the shaft of the T.
Right.
You've got these sort of slightly notional rivers. The Nile is the right-hand part, the Nile slash the Red Sea. And then the left-hand part is the River Don, which, of course, is a real river in Russia. I always got confused by this because somebody in something I read was like, this is the Don as in Doncaster. I, you know, great Greek astronomer Ptolemy writing in Alexandria in the 2nd century, writing about Doncaster. But no, it is the Don in Russia. So yeah, this is the world divided along those lines. But yeah, no, Asia is massive, and Jerusalem, actually, it has to be kind of slightly more than half, because Jerusalem, of course, is in Asia, and Jerusalem has to be at the center. This is about, you know, the world. Jerusalem is at the center of the world. And on this map, you've not just got this kind of walled city of Jerusalem looking like a cartwheel. And it's been done like you've got the compass hole, right? You can see where they stuck a compass in the map and they drew it as a nice circle around Jerusalem. And then you've got the crucified Jesus above Jerusalem as well. So this is very much like the center of things is Jesus. So Jesus appears twice. He's right at the top, standing in majesty with everybody who's been saved on his right and everybody who's been damned on his left. And then right underneath him, at the eastmost point of the map, is the Garden of Eden with four rivers flowing out of it. And in fact, when Columbus got to America on his third voyage, he got to the continent of South America. First two voyages, he didn't. He just went to the Caribbean. Got to the continent of South America and came to the mouth of the Orinoco River. And he felt the Orinoco River flowing out towards him, because I think it's got an incredible volume, the Orinoco. Mm.
And Columbus was there going, can anyone hear Enya?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So he's there with his Orinoco flow, and the water is fresh, and it's flowing out towards him. So he was convinced that this was one of the rivers flowing out of Eden that was kind of in the biblical text. Wow. And he was like, he's trying to sail uphill because there's this strong river flow out towards him. So he was convinced that he'd found the Garden of Eden, because Columbus, that not everybody realizes, was a massive visionary. Like he was convinced that he was a prophet. He used to sign himself Christoferens. Christoferens, meaning the bearing Christ, and Colombo means dove, so he called himself the Christ bearing dove. So he thought he was going to like be a new prophet, and he had found the Garden of Eden.
And which maps did Columbus base his journey on? So would the Hereford Mappamundi be something that Columbus might have used for reference?
The Hereford Mappamundi is used for kind of religious contemplation. And I'll come back to that in a second. But what Columbus basically did was he took all the sources he could find that might possibly support what he wanted to believe, and he compiled them together and was like, look, I'm right. So he took the lowest estimate for the size of the Earth to make it possible that that he could go around it. And he found prophecies in kind of apocryphal books of the Bible, and like wherever he could find it, he was like, This supports my argument. I'm going to say that this one is right.
You get that a lot, the idea of, okay, well, I have an idea about what the world looks like, so I'm going to make my vision of it fit. Like the idea of there being a Northwest Passage, so where you could sort of make your way around the top bit of North America through to the Atlantic, which is just drawn on so many maps for hundreds of years because everyone was convinced it existed. It just hadn't been found yet. Yeah, it's supposed to be there.
If I was a sensible deity, then this is how I would design the Earth.
Yes. They're all playing Slarty Bard fast.
Yeah. Yes.
But going back to what the Hereford fits into this, it was probably hung above the tomb of a saint, St. Thomas Cantaloupe, which is a great name, I think.
Tommy Mellon. Old Tommy Mellon.
The tomb became a shrine, because of course the whole purpose of making saints in the Middle Ages was to boost the tourist trade to your cathedral, because the pilgrims bring money, they bring fame, they bring donations, and then you're made. And
imagine if that was still around. Instead of like hosting the Olympics or a World Cup to get people to your country, you just like declared a saint.
But no, anyway, so these pilgrims would come to the tomb, they'd kind of pay their respects at the tomb of the saint, and then they would be reminded by this beautiful decorative massive scale map of where they fitted into the kind of history of humanity and where they fitted in the grand scheme of things. And some people even think that actually the Minotaur that I mentioned before on the island of Crete, because of course the Minotaur, legendary beast, was imprisoned in a labyrinth. and cathedrals often had labyrinths on the floor that pilgrims could kind of walk around as a kind of extra little pilgrimage and a sort of meditative activity, that they could kind of do this walking around the labyrinth. And the Minotaur is in one of those on the island of Crete, which is kind of massively oversized in the middle of the Mediterranean. Yes. The Mediterranean itself, by the way, is kind of shaped like the body of Christ. So there's like a nice curve in the western part of the Mediterranean where his kind of waist and his hips and his legs are. And then his arm is the Adriatic. And then his head is the Cyclades Islands in Greece. So it kind of, the whole thing, if you sort of squint at it, looks a bit like a human body. Again, it's all intended to kind of make you think about it.
I like the idea of Christ in the middle in Jerusalem on the cross. And surely they've missed a trick by not turning him into a compass.
Yeah. Or just having, like, instead of INRI above his head, having Welcome to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at a picture of it here. Is I really like that they've gone quite literal with the Red Sea and coloured it red.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it's kind of faded over the years, and it was really bright red when they first made it. Like, they've reconstructed the map, and it's absolutely bright red. And if you look at the Red Sea, there's a little path across the Red Sea where the Israelites crossed. Like, I don't know how up you are on your biblical history. And there's this brilliant line. If you follow the line, it starts in Egypt, and then it goes across the Red Sea, and then it kind of wiggles through what must be Sinai, and it does this, like, massive loop. And then it kind of ends up passing Sodom and Gomorrah, where you can see Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt. And then it ends up at Jericho in the Promised Land. So you've got this kind of wibbly wobbly line where the Israelites didn't quite go straight because they were, you know, getting confused on the way. So there's all these things. So yeah, there's all the biblical stuff. You've got the Tower of Babel, you've got Noah's Ark, but there is also all these kind of here be dragons type stuff, the myths about, like, what else is in the world. And that comes also from, like, a religious place as well. It's like God's incredible creativity, basically. Like, why should we think that what is around us is all there is? That would just be kind of narrow-minded. There's bound to be these mythical beasts because, you know, like you say with the Northwest Passage, if I was God, I'd make people with their eyes in their chests. Like India, there are these people who have one leg. They're called monoculi, like one leg, monoculi. And their one foot is enormous, and they use it to shade themselves from the sun. Yeah. So they're sort of sitting there, lying on their backs with this enormous foot being used as a sunshade.
I was just going to say, it's incredible. It's like the maps were designed by Terry Gilliam.
Well, I mean, I think maybe Terry Gilliam kind of is quite inspired by medieval like art and art.
Yes, you're right.
And thinking and that kind of thing. And then in Scandinavia, so around the boundaries of Europe, you've got these sort of things that maybe are based on reality or based on kind of travelers' tales. Like, you've got the Griste people in sort of, I suppose, what would now be the Baltic states, who make saddles from the skins of their enemies. And then you've got these sort of unrealistic looking people in Scandinavia who, like, travel on the snow with bits of wood on their feet. I mean, how would you even do that? And then, of course, it wouldn't be complete as a map without hating the French. So you've got Paris looking quite grand, but someone at some point got, like, a massive, like, sharp thing and drew great big lines across Paris. Like, they really tried to scrub out Paris because they were just so annoyed with the French about something. And then, do you want me to tell you about the animals?
Oh, dear. Yeah.
So, you know, you've got your bears in Scandinavia, sure. You've got your tigers. There's an elephant in Egypt that has a kind of castle on its back. You know, that presumably because somebody somewhere had seen an elephant with one of those, what do they call them, howdahs, you know, this sort of giant frame that people can sit in. But these elephants were so big, they had castles on their backs. And then, of course, you've got the, like, truly mythical animals, like the lynx by the Black Sea that urinates precious stones. there's the Bonacon, which is this kind of slightly scary cow-like thing. Nobody's quite sure what it is. It's shit. It's burning. Like, if you touch it's shit, you burn up. And then you've got, of course, you've got the unicorn. And the unicorn, there's a little corner of Egypt which has, you know, it has Alexandria, it has Memphis, it has all these places that are real places, but it also has a salamander, which is a lizard that can live in fire. It has the mandrake, which, if you remember your Harry Potter, is this incredibly humanistic plant, humanoid plant. And then it has the unicorn. These things often, these come out of books called bestiaries, which are basically medieval. It's a genre of medieval writing where animals are often really beautifully drawn. Information about them is collated often from like classical writers, people like Pliny, if you've heard of, or Solinus, writers, Roman and Greek writers who wrote about animals and observed them. And they collated together all these stories and put them all together. And they drew these pictures. And basically, the more information you can have, the better. And the whole point of it was to convey moral lessons, right? So the hedgehog, back to the hedgehog again. I love hedgehogs. But anyway, the hedgehogs in these bestiaries, what they said about them was that the hedgehogs would basically either climb trees or go to the bottom of trees and try and shake the trees, apple trees, fruit trees, until all the fruit fell out of the tree. And then they would roll over the fruit on the ground so that the apples or whatever fruit would stick to their spines. They would carry the fruit that stuck to their spines like little cocktail sticks to their nest. And then their young would get the fruit off the spines and they had something to eat. And of course, the moral is, you know, you've got to provide for your young and the hedgehog looks out for its children. And that's a kind of a straightforward moral. The moral of a dog is it's very loyal, and you know we have to be loyal to God, and we have to kind of confess our sins to God. But dogs eat their own vomit, which basically shows that we're all sinners and we're all ultimately going to revert to our sins and go back to them anyway. So there's always a kind of a double-edged moral.
That's what I think whenever I see a dog chowing down on its own vom.
You're a miserable sinner, Ben.
Yeah.
And with the unicorn is a great one, right? Because unicorns were generally believed to exist, although nobody had ever seen one. And unicorn horns were traded in the later Middle Ages as being these enormously long, sometimes 8 foot long, beautiful spiraling horns, which we now know are narwhal horns, right? Mm. Narwhal, they're like aquatic mammal, but they're massively, massively long, right? So what kind of a beast can carry this enormous long horn? Well, there was already this kind of myth that the unicorn was associated with Jesus. Very rare, very special, very precious animal. And because Jesus had humbled himself to come into human form, so the unicorn must be a very small, very humble animal. So you have a very small animal with an enormously long horn, must be incredibly strong and fierce. That was the assumption that they made, that if it's strong enough to carry a horn, it must be really fierce, so it fights with elephants. But there is one way that this animal can be tamed, and that is you get a virgin. It's always a virgin. You take her into the woods. You get her just to sit down and be calm and quiet. And then the unicorn will approach her and will put its head in her lap. And then the hunters can leap out and jump on the unicorn and catch it. And the allegory here, of course, is that Jesus humbled himself by coming down into a virgin's womb, by putting himself into the Virgin Mary, just as the unicorn puts its head in the virgin's lap. And it says all this on the map, right? You look at the Mappamundi and it's covered with text, and you've got this whole story about how the unicorn can be captured by a virgin. It'll put its head in her lap. Not quite sure where it'll put its horn, but you know, this is how you catch a unicorn.
If I had heard the story of how Jesus was a unicorn at school, I would be at church 8 days a week. It seems very much that the Hereford Mappamundi is the gift that keeps on giving, but most of the gifts are the wrong ones that you didn't ask for. I think before in a previous episode, we have talked about the phrase "here be dragons" and how it's actually sort of apocryphal, and it's only really appeared on one map. It's Hic Sunt Dracones, and it's on something called the Hunt Lennox Globe. You're much more likely to see Hic Sunt Leones, here are lions. But my favourite sort of version of it is on a map called the Fra Mauro map. On it says, there are a number of dragons in whose forehead is a stone that cures many infirmities. So basically suggesting existence of basilisks, which is always a very exciting notion.
Yeah.
A map from the 10th century on it exists this brilliant piece of Latin, which in Latin, on the southernmost tip of Africa, it says, it starts off authoritative, but then becomes a little bit more anecdotal. It translates as, this region of Zugis is in Africa. It is rather fertile, but on the other hand, it is full of beasts and serpents, which is a little bit of a plot twist at the end there. Going back to our pal Gerardus Mercator, or Gerald Mercer, as I prefer to call him, he was someone who tried to work out the problem of how compasses work and how magnetic north worked. And his solution was something called the Rupes Nigra, or the Black Rock. And he believed that at the North Pole, there was a 33-mile-wide giant magnetic black rock. And in a map of his published in 1595, there is this giant black rock surrounded by a sea. And then around that sea, there are four other islands and tributaries coming in towards it. And the problem is, I've read too much Discworld. And all I can see is that is essentially, that must be where Terry Pratchett got the idea of Corrie Celesti, this giant ice mountain in the center of the world.
I mean, they were really interested in what magnetism was, right? Like, going right back to the early Middle Ages, they've got lodestones, and they're like, how does this thing work? St. Augustine, like, great theologian, is writing about how some guy he knows went to a dinner party in North Africa where this guy put this lodestone underneath a tray and then put some metal things on top, and the metal things moved by magic, and he's like trying to describe the properties of this magnetism. And then the compass comes in like the 12th century. It was in China much earlier, of course. And they're all trying to figure out how it works. Like, does it point to the pole star, or does it point to something on Earth? And if it points to something on Earth, what could that possibly be? And then there's this whole like, well, the pole star itself moves slightly, so does that affect things? So, you know, this is a real subject for scientific investigation for medieval scholars.
Magnetism is one of those things that any layman can look at that immediately looks like magic.
Yeah. These stories about how in some unspecified Muslim country, there's like a statue of Muhammad that floats, and it's they explain it by, you know, magnets, kind of North and South Pole magnets pushing against each other.
Well, that sounds like me trying to explain the internet, though. It's just like, I don't know, magnets.
Yeah. Basically, just David Copperfield just absolutely rocking it in Mecca somewhere.
Exactly.
I make it float, I make it appear, I make it disappear, I turn Muhammad into a tiger. Hello, listeners in Saudi Arabia. Now, we've talked about, you know, some good, bad, and ugly map makers, but we've not talked about map makers who have got it steadfastly wrong, and other map makers have believed them for upwards of a century. Gentlemen, may I introduce you to the Mountains of Kong?
Yes.
This is incredible.
Yes.
So, Mungo Park, a famous Scottish explorer, had a little bit of a poke around in Central and West Africa. And he was going in search of the source of the Nile. And he came back and he showed his findings to an English cartographer named James Rennell, who was a brilliant man. He was the father of oceanography. He did a lot of remarkable cartography work, specifically around the Indian subcontinent. But for reasons that I don't fully understand, Mungo Park went, yeah, mate, there's an enormous mountain range. And when I mean enormous, I mean I'm talking from the west part of Nigeria all the way over to Sierra Leone that is literally hundreds, if not over 1,000 miles. It was a mountain range that went up above the clouds and began to appear on maps from 1798 onwards, and it continued all the way through to 1892, and they only disappeared from maps when a French explorer named Louis Gustave Binger went on an expedition to establish whether they were fictitious, and he came back after a three-year expedition to go, yeah, mate, they're not there.
Do we think that Park made the whole thing up because he's like, oh, my map's a bit empty here, I better put something in? Or was it like, you know, when you take your kids for a walk and they're like, oh, this is the highest mountain in the world. Yeah, I'm so tired. This mountain must be enormous.
Well, it could well be that he made it up. There's a lot of early maps of Africa are very, very empty. Understandably, because European explorers found it very difficult going, and it's enormous. But so Africa, I think, did get filled up with an awful lot of fictitious land masses and countries and imagery, like in the Hereford Mappamundi, partially because if you've been away for 5 years, you want to have a good story to tell the people who have funded your expedition. And also because there are so many remarkable things in Africa, giraffes and elephants, for one, that it's pretty easy to embellish on top of that. And yeah, when you return with a map, if it's a bit empty, it's pretty embarrassing, isn't it?
Yeah, you sort of get to, well, you can sort of go, well, of course we haven't done the bottom half. There's these vast mountains we have to try and pass through to get there.
Yeah, so the mountains of Kong are the world's greatest excuse.
But they appeared on maps for ages. The mountains of Kong appeared in an atlas in 1995.
Wow.
What?
Yeah, Good's World Atlas, 1995, still included the mountains of Kong.
They did. Well, it's because map making, is before, you know, satellite maps stood up, were essentially a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy.
We referenced this in a past podcast, I can't remember when, and I in reading about the A to Z and the Pearsall's company, they used to put phantoms into their map. So these are deliberate copyright protection, non-existent roads. They won't put like a massive artery or something, but like if there's a tiny little group of cul-de-sacs, they might stick an extra one in as like, because then if someone else produces a map with that non-existent road on it, then they'll have copied from the A to Z. In time, someone will ring them up and say, hey, this road doesn't exist, and they'll remove that one and put a different phantom in somewhere else.
Another word for this is a mount weasel.
Oh, yes.
Which is absolutely cracking name, isn't it? And I found about a brilliant fictional American town called Agloe, A-G-L-O-E, in New York. And it's exactly the same thing. It's to protect their maps from people copying them without paying the due copyright. A couple of chaps, Ernest Alpers and Otto G. Lindberg, created Agloe by using a combination of the first letters of their names. It was in the 1930s, and they positioned it in the Western Catskills. And they noticed that it started to be listed on a chap called Rand McNally's maps. And so they sued his company. However, in a surprise ruling, Rand McNally was judged innocent. Now, how could that possibly happen when this place doesn't exist? Well, it turns out that at the exact spot where the imaginary Agloe was supposed to be, someone who had seen the original general drafting maps had built an Agloe general store. And therefore, the guy who copied the map, Rand McNally, won the argument by saying, well, the store's there, so there must be an Agloe.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and it's been described in printed maps for over 90 years, and it even made it onto Google Maps.
No.
But it was removed in 2014.
That's so good.
I met a guy who had an island on a map named after him. I do a bit of sailing, which I think you mentioned at the beginning.
Yes.
When you're training to be a sailor, you learn how to do navigation using all of these fictional maps, because if you want to learn how to do it, you might as well cover a map with all of the different features you might possibly find, and so that you can learn, you know, how to find these kinds of things in the water or how to deal with the tides in this way. So when they produce this course, the RYA, the Royal Yachting Association, produced this course, which is now like done internationally, they had to make up this fake map. They wanted it all to be realistic. So what they did was they took little chunks of real maps and they kind of stitched them together in a weird jigsaw. So they had like a bit of, you've got like a bit of Cape of Good Hope here, you've got a bit of Portsmouth Harbour there, you've got a bit of New Zealand in the elsewhere, and it's all just kind of shoved together. And then the UK Hydrographic Office said, okay, yeah, we can model the tides for this because we've already got the models for the real places. We'll just kind of combine them together. But of course, they had to give new names to all of the places because they couldn't just call it like New Zealand and Table Bay and all the rest of it. So they kind of just made up random names. So the guys who kind of designed the first course just named all the places after themselves. So this guy is called Slade. I can't remember his first name, but he's got Slade Island named after himself. and so if you ever take one of these sailing theory courses, you'll kind of be in this weird mythical land of made up places.
Amazing. And whenever you land on Slade Island, you have to go, it's an island. There's a wonderful history of maps that are made to look like other things, like animals or human beings, that frankly I have neither the time or the expertise to go into. But some of my favorites, there's a map from 1793 which reimagines the United Kingdom as John Bull, John Bull, if you don't know, was a personification of the British spirit. Just imagine the worst kind of obstreperous Brexity gammoneer. Imagine if they were turned into an underwhelming Marvel superhero, and that is what John Bull is.
Mark Francois Man.
Yeah, yes, precisely. Mark Francois Man. That's perfect. Well, there is an image of the United Kingdom reimagined as John Bull farting out of Sussex and Hampshire to repel a French invasion of ships.
Are these the new Brexit border controls?
There is another one from a couple of years earlier, and clearly the British self-image improved a lot between 1791 and 1793, because 1791, it reimagines the United Kingdom as an old lady riding backwards on a fish. So her head and hood is most of Scotland, and then she has a hand going out to a dove, which is out to Anglesey, and her cloak sort of whips out to be Wales in the southwest, and then the fish is basically from the tip of Norfolk and the Wash, going in a line all the way down to Bristol, and then its tail is Cornwall, and then the Thames goes into the fish's mouth, and there's a little sort of flipper, which is the Isle of Wight. And it is, I have to say, a deeply ugly fish. And there's quite a lot of famous ones as well of from late Victorian, early Edwardian era of illustrating the various allegiances of countries in Europe. And there's a lot of propagandist stuff. There's a very famous one of Russia as a giant octopus sticking its tentacles into various countries. But there's another absolutely brilliant one that I found, which is called Europe Angling in Troubled Waters, where instead of an octopus, it's just got Tsar Nicholas. And for some reason, Sweden in Scandinavia is represented by a very long dachshund. And it's... so one last thing, and this is a great story that, I don't know, maybe is better known to historians of the Napoleonic Wars, but Napoleon famously lost the Battle of Waterloo in 1815.
Ben, I was going to watch it on catch up later on.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Spoiler alert. And according to a chap called Frank Ferrand, it's because Napoleon aimed his artillery in the wrong direction so that the artillery fell short of the British, Dutch and Prussian lines. And the reason he did that was because of an inaccurate map.
Yeah.
And due to a printing error, the site Mont-Saint-Jean-Farm was 1 kilometre from its true position, which means that Napoleon misdirected his guns. So there's a very real chance that one of the reasons Napoleon lost was due to a printing error.
That is so good. The American Special Forces, and when they invaded Grenada, it was in the 70s or the 80s, they had been planning to invade Lebanon. It was around the time of the crisis in Lebanon, and all the talk was America's going to end up invading Lebanon. And sort of suddenly they're like, no, we're invading Grenada. And they were like, we don't have maps of Grenada. So some guy in Fort Bragg went into the town and bought like some tourist maps of Grenada, because they were like shipping out the next day. So they bought a couple of... So they invaded Grenada largely on the info contained in some tourism maps.
Good thing they didn't end up in Granada, Spain, instead of Grenada.
Well, yes, quite.
Yeah, the little-known Anglo-Spanish War of the 20th century.
Yeah.
But for my choice, we've gone to another Worst Foot Forward favourite. We're going to Soviet Russia. In the post-World War II world, there was still quite a lot of Russia that was uncharted, and Stalin sent out various cartographers to the Siberian wilderness, and some of the stories are pretty harrowing. There's a chap called Alexei Postnikov, and he wrote that he went out on a expedition to southern Yakutia in the 1960s, and he found a note scrawled on a tree trunk by one of his predecessors, and it was dated November the 20th, 1948, and it simply says, "All my reindeers have perished. The food stores became bear's prey. I am left with a very sick junior surveyor on my hands. I have no transportation or means of subsistence."
I carved on a tree, did you say?
Carved on a tree.
Wow.
Big tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
PTO.
Khrushchev took map making to an even more sort of sinister advance. because he was someone who wanted to continue spreading communism around the world, and he wanted to sort of match European colonialism, he saw the possibility of turning newly liberated countries in Africa and South Asia to communism. And the way he did it was by sending the military to undertake foreign mapping expeditions there as a way of insidiously getting inside the nation's infrastructure. And one of the reasons why Russian maps of other countries were so precise was because that America, generally speaking, had a far superior air force, whereas Soviets' advance in, or the Soviet advantage militarily, was in their tank brigades. So by having much better land maps, then they would be able to release the tanks. All of their maps do suggest that these were maps that were preparing for an invasion. So, for example, there is one map has tables on the range of audibility of various sounds. So apparently a snapping twig can be heard 80 meters away. Troop movements on foot can be heard 300 meters on a dirt road or 600 on a highway. An idling tank up to 1,000 meters or a rifle shot can be 4,000 meters. Also, if you have an idling tank outside of a school, it is best to turn the ignition off because of global warming. It also goes into extraordinary detail. There's a map for a place called Altan Emel, which is on the border of Mongolia and Russia, but it's in China. Mm. And it includes details as specific as the lakes are not usually large, up to 7 kilometers squared with a depth of up to 1 meter. They are low, gentle, partially swamped. The bottom is slimy and viscous. Some of the lakes have salted or alkaline water. And one of the experts that I read about, this chap called Kent Lee, has said, cartographic culture is to Russia as wine culture is to France. And military maps are still a very touchy topic in Russia. As recently as 2012, a former military topographic officer was sentenced to 12 years in prison for allegedly leaking classified maps to the West. Now, so far, this is so impressive and very definitely not bad. But the reason I emphasise this is, for as good as military maps are in Soviet Russia, civilian maps are very deliberately very, very bad. Because up until Gorbachev took over and began reforms in Russia of glasnost and perestroika, Soviet Union deliberately falsified all public maps in the country to confuse its opponents during the Cold War. This is despite the fact that because America has such brilliant satellite imaging and spy planes, that it didn't matter. They misplaced rivers and streets. They distorted national boundaries. They omitted geographical features, all as a way of trying to confuse the Americans. There's a chap called Viktor Yushchenko, who was the chief mapmaker of government newspaper, the Izvestia, and he said, "We received numerous complaints."
Not surprised. I'm amazed the letters of complaints reached them.
Yeah. He says, people did not recognize their motherland on maps. Tourists tried in vain to orient themselves on the terrain. American diplomats and correspondents based in Moscow found that their most reliable street map of Moscow was produced by the CIA. And
that's so good.
This is from a newspaper article I read from 1988, and Yushchenko says, the work became senseless with the appearance of space photography, as I said, but nevertheless it continued right until 1988. For example, on the tourist map of Moscow, the only thing that is accurate about it are the contours. Everything else is essentially a lie. In the evening paper Vyshchennaya Moskva, they recently complained in 1988. They said, you can get maps of our country in many countries of the world that are accurate, apart from in the USSR. From whom, one wonders, are we keeping secrets? It would seem it would be from ourselves. My favourite thing with the CIA map is that obviously on the map printed by the Soviets, they moved everything about and they omitted various things. The CIA map is a bit of a throwdown to the Russians. They very clearly marked the KGB building. But my favourite thing about these maps is that the person who designed these inaccurate maps of the Soviet Union won the highest cartography prize in the nation and was awarded it by Stalin.
3 days late because no one could get to the venue.
Yeah. Our nominations for the world's worst map are Barry's of Orlando Ferguson's map of the square and stationary Earth, a strange, otherworldly, multidimensional piece of cartographical bullshit. Seb's biblically and mythologically inspired Hereford Mappamundi, and my nomination of every single map produced in the Soviet Union from 1945 to 1988. Gentlemen, what a journey we have been on. Before I invited Seb on this show, he did say, listen, I don't want to make out that the people of the medieval world were backward idiots who wouldn't know their arsehole from their elbow. So I don't want to make the people of the medieval world look bad.
They'll probably email with complaints.
Yeah. Well, and what he very much wanted to emphasise, the medieval world was very much not the Dark Ages that we know of, but very much the Light Ages, which incidentally is the name of his book that is available in all good bookstores from September. I want to pour over the Hereford Mappamundi, and whilst it may not be accurate, it is fascinating.
Yeah.
I'm going to discount that from the world's worst map. So I'm genuinely torn, and you lads are going to have to help me, because Orlando Ferguson is just the kind of idiot that we like to celebrate on this show. And he's like a Champions League flat earther, because he's a flat earther, but his map is not flat. It looks like someone has put a map into some sort of strange physics modelling computer software and come out with the weirdest thing ever. But I love the fact that the Soviets basically took their doublethink to a whole new level and tried to falsify their entire nation, and the only people they confused was themselves.
I like the fact that the contours are still accurate. That's a really nice touch. Like, yeah. they're not just going to completely make it up. They're going to keep something right. That's sweet. I like that.
God almighty, I'm so torn. What do you think, Barry?
Oh, obviously I think Orlando Ferguson, Ben.
Yeah, okay, you do. Okay. Okay, we'll come to a compromise. I'm going to say that specifically the Russian part of Orlando Ferguson's map is the world's worst map ever made. So congratulations to both Orlando and the state of Mother Russia. Briefly, before we go, we're going to give you the world's best news of the week, as we will continue to do so until this pandemic shenanigans ends. And we go to Brooklyn, where a lovely young man called Brian Rumfeldt, who is 7 years old, has launched a Facebook group where he's been reading stories to other kids who may not be attending school and might be missing out on story time. And it's adorable because Brian looks like, essentially, a New York taxi driver if he was 7.
Amazing!
He's called it Brian's Book Corner, and if you have children who you would like to have stories read to them by a 7-year-old New Yorker, please do it. And he was inspired by his grandma reading to him every night, and she suggested that he read to other kids who don't have story time, so he did, and it's become an online sensation.
That is amazing.
Adorable. Before we go, Seb, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Yeah, people can find me online, sebfalk.com, or on Twitter, at @seb_falk. Absolutely, my book is out in September, The Light Ages. I hope people will enjoy it.
Smashing stuff. Well, we're all off on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem using Orlando Ferguson's map, so imagine you can find us going round and round in circles somewhere outside Budapest. Until next time, friends, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward, and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @Podnose, or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.